Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, January 13th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, redwood trees being removed on property in Lower Redway, part 1 of 2. Offshore wind energy advocates highlight private sector and state support. Community assistant helps locate missing at-risk juvenile. Stay tuned, those stories and more, coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
This is part one of a two-part story about the redwood tree removal in Redway. KMUD is still reaching out to different agencies and the owner of the property for more information. This is the first part from the perspective of a former environmentalist, a retired forester, the CEO of a logging company that was hired to do the project, and Cal Fire. In Humboldt, California, towering redwoods can be seen in every direction. Some have grown and stood for centuries. Over the last week and into this week, redwood trees are being removed in Redway, a town in Humboldt. This has sparked anger, confusion, and grief for many in the community. To understand why this tree removal is creating such turbulence in the community, the history of redwood protection has been ongoing for decades. KMUD talked with Susan Maloney, a former environmental activist, that has lived in the area since the 90s.
So I got here in 1996 to Humboldt County, and so many people were already here putting their bodies on the line trying to save these trees. Many of the patches were larger areas, many, many acres that were trying to be saved. And people were coming literally from all over the country to try to save these. And people were doing, you know, they were working on the legal side of things. Lots of us did initiative work and legislative work. People were climbing trees. People were out in the woods trying to stop loggers when they finally, you know, were logging. People were chaining themselves to heavy equipment in the woods. Here's a crazy story. People got their eyes held open and pepper spray dabbed in them at a couple of actions, and to add insult to injury, the insurance company was videotaping it in hopes of using it as a example of how law enforcement could use pepper spray in protesters' eyes in the future. I mean, it's the history here is really incredulous. And then we had Daryl Cherney and Judy Berry in the 90s get bombed. Someone put a motion-censored bomb in their car, and that was never fully investigated. So people have been doing amazing work and going to great lengths trying to save these trees.
This current project includes several large redwoods and at least one confirmed old-growth redwood tree, which have been approved for removal or heavy pruning under a hazard-based exemption. Maloney says this removal feels unprecedented in this area.
I'm not aware of much that's gone on in this Lower Redway area. I mean, homes were built in around these trees since Pacific Lumber had this as a summertime area for people to visit when it was so, you know, in the woods, and people would come down here from Scotia. And so we have these groves of trees where then people moved into around them, you know, in all of these instances. People have known that these trees are here for hundreds. They outdate all of us by hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So it's no surprise that we know that we're getting in, what we're getting into when we move into these areas.
Mm-hmm. According to David Hope, a retired forester, there are questions about the intent of this removal, questioning the hazard-based exemption, and pointing out the price of old-growth redwood spiking recently.
This happens fairly often, especially when redwood prices spike. People go after trees. Now, old growth are especially desirable because they're worth about three times as much as the second growth redwood. So we've always found these problems occurring when redwood prices spike.
According to Hope, the price used to be about $1 per board foot, but is now around $10 per board foot. KMUD was able to talk to Robert Carpenter, the CEO of Tree Ventures, Incorporated, the company that was hired for the project. He talked about the outcry from the community for his, quote, ignorance, end quote.
I practice sustainable forest yield, which is knowing how to thin forest properly. And being fourth generation in this, I decided to not be like my grandfather and his dad, or my dad, and learn how to log properly like Oregon does, where they thin forests for fire hazard.
He confirmed that there is at least one old growth that was planned to be taken down but has been passed over to PG&E because of the danger to power lines in the area.
On this particular job, these old growth, one of them for sure is an old growth, and the one that's for sure an old growth, we only are removing the limbs for safety, which we just shut down because of the hazard to the power lines. So now we're passing it to PG&E.
He explained that California's harsh rules with insurance, there is no need to remove brush and trees within 30 feet of the home.
I've been doing this for most of my life. And like I said, that's why I went and learned how to do it properly, unlike just being a tree killer. If you talk to any of our customers or our clients, I'm an advocate for saving a tree before removing it. But sometimes when it comes to California and their harsh implemented rules with insurance, they make you remove a lot of shrubs and a lot of trees that were within 30 feet of a home. And then they want the 100 to 150 foot fire clearance on a home and don't understand that in our coastal area, it's not necessarily needed. So that's where you need somebody that is educated enough to know how to select pick and how to properly lift canopies and get things away from the home. And that's generally what we do, unless the customer's like, hey, it shades our house, we don't get any sun, we need the tree gone. That's a personal preference, and I understand that, and I don't mind doing that for those reasons. It's not just a money scheme for our company, it's proper tree care.
There has been claims that the approval for these removals, for these removals were rushed. Carpenter explained that this is not true at all, and that for projects with old-growth redwoods, there are many agencies that need to approve before the project can begin.
We have every agency under the sun that has checked this out. Fishing Game, Coastal Commission, California. You got to remember, county supersedes state on anything. People think it's the other way around. It's run by county. So the true authority is county. Hence why state law can be one thing and a county ordinance is another. So when you're dealing with old growth, there's a large amount of people you got to deal with to get approval. And this went all the way up to the top. Katie Bushnell approved it, the county supervisor for that district, through the county of Humboldt. Cal Fire approval you have to have for defensible space permit, which is the 150 permit that you get through CalFire.org. Fish and Game looked at it, Coastal Commission looked at it to make sure it's not within the coastal zone. Fish and Game for any tributaries, fish, then following the guidelines, the customer had already pre-done his homework and he did the work prior to us coming in and being hired.
According to Lucas Titus, a forester in Humboldt del Norte County and is in charge of the overseeing timber harvest operations in southern Humboldt, said this was only approved by Cal Fire.
The harvest document was received and approved by Cal Fire region office down in Santa Rosa on December 16th. It was received on December 15th. It was approved on December 16th. And in order to harvest, or in order for a document to be approved like this, there's some sideboards, basically, that as long as you fall under these, that you're not going to, you know, if you're not going to take or remove certain species or certain trees for habitat, like you will not be, you know, impacting the water courses. You won't be cutting spotted owl trees as nest trees and different things like that. Then you do not have to have approval from Fish and Game. You're basically exempt from that because you're falling under these other specific guidelines.
Hope shared his past experience as a forester and how he would approach a project like this.
I would approach it by limbing the trees, is what everybody else in the neighborhood does. If you limb the trees, that reduces the hazard of limbs falling off during windstorms. Native Americans never lived in those forests during the winter because that's an inherent danger. The limbs are extremely dangerous when they come zooming down at who knows how many miles an hour. They stick in the ground, you know, 6 feet, and anything in between the air and the 6 feet is going to get damaged. Looking at that, there's trees being taken down that, you know, are over 100 feet away from the house. I've never in my life, in all my experience, 70 years of living in the forest, ever seen a redwood limb go that far. So the problem is that, you know, the homeowner doesn't have the knowledge that he needs to have to deal with this problem, and the agencies are not giving him good guidance. So they give him an open window, and if you can drive a truck through it, somebody will. So that's kind of what's going on. He's taking advantage of a gap in the rules. We spent 10 years trying to tighten up the rules on exemptions being used for cutting old growth. And here's an example of how it's not working.
Maloney shared what this tree removal means to her and the many others who have been fighting for decades to protect redwood trees.
It's just really sad to see this happening right now. And those of us who have been doing this work are larger than we used to be, and it's just really, really sad to see this happening. I hope we can do something in the future to work with the county, perhaps, or parks, or CAL FIRE to make sure that this doesn't continue to happen. Yeah.
This is an ongoing story, and KMUD still needs to talk to the landowner, CAL FIRE, and the Humboldt Planning Department. The status of offshore wind energy and how it's being both challenged and supported was the subject of a recent online meeting, Daniel Mintz reports.
As federal support for offshore wind energy is upended, industry advocates are noting future potential and the scale of state and private sector investment. Offshore wind planning, contracting, and investment were summarized during a January 7th online presentation to the Community Economic Resilience Consortium, which is led by Greg Foster of the Redwood Region Economic Development Commission. An audience of city and county officials, business owners, legislative representatives, and members of nonprofit groups were told of the U.S. offshore wind sector's progress. Humboldt County has a stake in the industry and vice versa, as wind energy projects are slated for areas 20 miles offshore of Eureka. Nancy Kirshner-Rodriguez of Oceantic Network, a nonprofit group that vouches for the U.S. offshore renewable energy industry, said $25.5 billion has been invested in various segments of the U.S. offshore wind supply chain. And although Republican-controlled federal policy is now falling against the offshore wind industry, Kirshner-Rodriguez said supporting it makes economic sense.
We've been doing a lot more work the last 6 months educating members of Congress about where supply chain has come from. And the, you know, we have this national supply chain database, and there's people in every state. I wanted to also, at this time when everyone is talking about the importance of shipbuilding, the interesting thing is there have actually been vessels built in the U.S., large, some of the largest.
She added the total investment is relative to Humboldt, quote, just to see the amount that has been invested already in the U.S. supply chain and the potential opportunities that we hope will emerge. The Trump administration's distaste for offshore wind energy is reflected in presidential executive orders and cancellations of grants, including a $427 million grant for redeveloping the county's Humboldt Bay port. But there's plenty of support for offshore wind energy on the state level, with funding approved for port development and the transmission infrastructure upgrades needed to distribute offshore wind energy. Astrid Dubois of the Brightline Defense Nonprofit Group talked about some takeaways from a November 2025 wind energy gathering in Humboldt.
One of the big takeaways, I think, from the meetings and panels in Humboldt came from Jana Gagnon with the governor's office saying, you know, how crucial it is for California and communities like Humboldt to be focusing on what are kind of like lower regrets, maybe like lower investment levels, or, you know, lower investments that need to happen anyways, or would have benefits to continue to showcase progress and make sure that, you know, for instance, things like the transmission is getting updated and developed and built out. And hopefully, you know, that will set everything up for offshore wind. But the reality also is that, you know, the federal landscape does have impacts and implications. And so kind of figuring out how to navigate that.
During a question and answer session, Wilfred Franklin of the North Coast Small Business Development Center said he's concerned about how the potential revival of nuclear power and its subsidization could offset offshore wind investment. Krishna Rodriguez had this response.
I do think that the current environment means that Diablo Canyon is not really going away anytime soon, at least right now. But I don't really see a lot of West Coast interest. And one of the points we're trying to make is, while it's true that nuclear is a clean power and there's the different kinds of reactors now, et cetera, there's still always, there's waste. And there's also the amount of time it would take to develop nuclear.
She added that offshore wind has, quote, a head start, which, quote, makes me feel a little more hopeful about it. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On January 6, 2026, at approximately 9:28 a.m., Eureka Police Department patrol officers responded to a report of a missing at-risk juvenile who was last seen near the area of 7th and C Streets. KMUD got an explanation from Laura Montagna, the Eureka Police Department's public information officer.
Community assistance helps locate missing at-risk juvenile. On January 6, 2026, at approximately 9:28 a.m., Eureka Police Department patrol officers responded to a report of a missing at-risk juvenile who was last seen near the area of 7th and C Streets. Based on several factors, EPD patrol officers and members of the Community Safety Engagement Team began checking the waterfront trail, while a criminal investigations unit detective canvassed other areas throughout the city. EPD personnel were assisted by Humboldt Bay Fire and the Crisis Alternative Response of Eureka team. Due to concerns the juvenile may have been headed toward Humboldt Bay, EPD requested assistance from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Marine Unit, Unmanned Aerial System Unit, and Search and Rescue K-9 team. While the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Marine Unit searched the bay, The drone was deployed and conducted an aerial survey of the waterfront trail. As a result of social media posts and information provided by community members, CIU detectives were able to safely locate the juvenile, who was subsequently reunited with their family. EPD would like to thank Humboldt Bay Fire, CARE, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, and community members for their assistance and collaboration in locating the juvenile.
In state news, Fresno activists join nationwide protests of ICE killing in Minneapolis. KPFA's Vic Bedoyan reports.
A robust protest by thousands of people held signs that communicated their feelings about the killing of Renee Good as they cheered the honking horns of drivers passing by along Blackstone Street. There was music playing and poetry being read as each person spoke their own message with graphics and voice. I'm using people's first names only for security reasons. Here is Joan's take on the event.
My encouragement is that I see an enormous crowd here, and I don't know many of them. And in the old days, when we were on the corner against the Iraq War, we all knew each other. We never saw any new faces. So this is an encouragement.
Leslie was holding a sign that said, "Get in good trouble," the famous quote from civil rights leader John Lewis.
I think that any time you see injustice happen, you need to do something about it. And peaceful protest is doing something about it.
Have you been to many of the demonstrations through the year?
Yeah, since 2016.
Diane, a longtime social activist here, talked about the local mobilization efforts.
We're beyond thinking that we're making any difference by demonstrating. It's not about us. It's about people
being able to be informed. And so that's why, you know, and so this is wonderful. When there's a huge crisis, then the Indivisible Group, they have a great networking system, so everybody kind of comes out.
One face-painted lady danced along the sidewalk reciting a poetical history lesson.
We are half-breeds. They colonized us. They enslaved us. They enforced us into forced labor. We are the people of the land, the people of the sun, the people of the food that you eat. The pyramids, we were here long before the colonizers. We are the people, the DNA of the land. We are not foreigners.
Suzanne carried a big American flag. I asked her why.
Because this is my flag. This belongs to everybody. And I'm here because ICE needs to go. Our president is running amok. And this is all really a distraction from the fact that he was involved in raping little girls.
She was referring, of course, to another Trump scandal, the Jeffrey Epstein files and Trump's association with him. But the main target of anger in this demonstration and what brought people out was ICE and its lethal actions, as expressed by Doug.
Renee Good. ICE murdered her. And it's clear as a bell. You watch the video, and no matter what side you see it on, he was wrong. He shot her 3 times. And the son of a gun should be put in jail. But that little wimp in the White House won't do it. He's too afraid that Putin might piss him off. You know, he's a puppet of Putin and all the other regimes.
Kelly said that the killing was a shocking moment and put people in the resistance on notice.
Oh, yeah, it's changed the dynamics of everything. That they can take us anytime they want to at this point. Kind of scary. It could have been anyone. And so I think that brought out more. Maybe it won't go unnoticed.
Looking at the big picture, Dee warned that ICE and its operations are part of a more ominous development in the nation.
Basically, ICE has become his Gestapo, and they're using it to terrorize communities and people. And it's really sad how racism has really raised its ugly head again. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a time when it was not considered acceptable to say and do some of the things that people are saying and doing nowadays. And I think that's why he's been able to do a lot of what he's doing with ICE, is because he has made racism acceptable again.
The ICE Out for Good protests organized by Indivisible took place in towns up and down the valley. There have been other spontaneous gatherings in the region, including at ICE headquarters in Fresno, where people came together to express their opposition to the current state of affairs. Vic Bedoyan reporting for the Pacifica Evening News and KFCF Radio.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The United States Supreme Court has once again declined to take up challenges to a federal law that protects subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. The court rejected the state of Alaska's petition to review a federal lawsuit against the state over salmon management on the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has more.
The state had argued the federal government was misinterpreting a law Congress passed to protect a rural priority for subsistence. Last year, after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with federal fishery managers, the state asked the Supreme Court to take up the case. But in a court docket on Monday, the Supreme Court denied the state's petition. The Alaska Federation of Natives hailed the decision. Its president, Ben Malott, says decades of hard-won protections under the landmark Katie John lawsuits were also on the line.
I feel relieved that we don't have to spend our limited resources and efforts fighting for what we know is right. Hopefully, our final time protecting what Katie John fought for.
John was an Otna Athabascan elder who fought for the right to fish on rivers that flow through federal lands. This is the third time the Supreme Court has decided to let Katie John litigation stand untouched. Alaska's Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang said in a statement that the state will respect the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court to not address legal issues regarding fish and game management authorities over navigable waters belonging to the state of Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Mary Peltola, a Yupik Democrat and the first Alaska Native person elected to Congress, announced Monday that she's running for U.S. Senate, taking on Republican incumbent Dan Sullivan. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Peltola served one partial and one full term in the U.S. House, then narrowly lost her seat in 2024. Her initial campaign videos portrayed her salmon-centered family life on the Kuskokwim River. She talks about the high cost of housing and groceries. She doesn't mention Sullivan by name.
The politicians representing us on Capitol Hill are more interested in appealing to D.C. partisans than to the Alaskans who elected them.
Nationally, Democrats believe that with Peltola on the ballot, Alaska presents one of their best hopes of flipping a Senate seat. Sullivan has already raised $6 million this election cycle. He has President Trump's endorsement and maintains a strong alignment with Trump. The National Republican Senatorial Committee and other groups supporting Sullivan issued a string of press releases. They link her to Joe Biden and other national figures on the left. Some Republican messages hit at her high rate of missed House votes. Peltola tried to head off that last point in her launch video, saying D.C. people were shocked that she went home in July to put up fish for her family. But she says Alaskans understand. For U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Peltola's candidacy presents a dilemma. They're both moderates, and Murkowski endorsed Peltola in the past, despite their party differences. Thursday, Murkowski said she'd made a decision.
We want to figure out how we're going to keep in the majority, and Dan delivers that.
So you would endorse Dan?
You know, yes, I guess I'm saying that I am endorsing my Republican partner.
I'm Liz Ruskin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Laura Montagna, Daniel Mintz, Vic Bedoyan, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605, or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.